Matthew 24:15 says, "When you therefore see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand." Very few places in the Scripture where you find Jesus saying that you need to understand this subject in this book of the Bible. And the pioneers correctly identify the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel as the papacy. Pioneers were correct. In the book of Daniel, the abomination of desolation is the papacy. Brothers and sisters, I know this is about country living, and I can very easy for me to get off in the prophecy. I'm going to try to keep it focused here on country living. But the pioneer is always related to the book of Daniel and Rome in a twofold fashion, whether it was the daily representing paganism, pagan Rome, in connection with the abomination of desolation, papal Rome. They were always seeing both phases of Rome. Okay, and in Daniel 8, verse 12 and 13, the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel is not the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel. It's the transgression of desolation. So in the book of Daniel, the abomination of desolation is found in Daniel 11, verse 31. It's found in verse 11 of chapter 12, but it's also found in Daniel 8. Only in Daniel 8 it's called the transgression of desolation. But in all of those places, the transgression of desolation, the abomination of desolation, the pioneers understood that that was the papacy. And in each of those places, this abomination of desolation or transgression of desolation, it's always in association with the daily. And the pioneers understood that the daily represented paganism, pagan Rome, and that the transgression or abomination of desolation represented papal Rome. Okay? There's reasons to be clear about that, that we won't go into at this point. But so what I'm telling you, if you will receive it, is that the pioneers correctly understood the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel as the papacy. Okay? Are we all on that page? So Jesus, in Matthew 24:15, says, everyone needs to understand the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel. So, what is the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel? Papacy. No. In the Great Controversy. Sister White says that this prophecy was fulfilled when pagan Rome placed its standards in the sacred precincts of Jerusalem. And this was a sign to the Christians in Jerusalem that they should stop what they were doing and get out of Jerusalem, because the destruction of Jerusalem was about to take place. And Sister White says not one Christian was destroyed in the destruction of Jerusalem. And I know we're all familiar with that in the beginning of the Great Controversy. So what's the discrepancy there? The discrepancy is that the abomination of desolation is a triple application of prophecy. And the pioneers were correct. And Ellen White is correct when she identifies it as pagan Rome. So, when you look at the first two times that the abomination of desolation is fulfilled, you will find the characteristics of the third time that it is fulfilled, established in those first two times. But before we do that, you're in Matthew 24:15. Turn to Mark 13:14. In Mark 13:14, this is Mark's record of this sermon of Jesus. It says, When ye shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing where it ought not. In Matthew it's standing in the holy place. But in Mark, it's standing where it ought not. And of course, pagan Rome should not be standing in the sacred precincts of the Temple of Jerusalem. But Mark and Matthew aren't disagreeing with each other. And they're broadening the definition of the abomination of desolation. Not only shouldn't it stand in the holy place, but it can stand where it ought not, let him that readeth understand. Then let them that be in Judea flee to the mountains. And look at Luke 20. Luke 21. And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out, and let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto. So what I'm suggesting, to try to keep it simple at the end of the day, is that the first fulfillment of the abomination of desolation took place in the AD 70 time period, when Titus came in, placed the standards of the army of Rome, which on those battle flags had the idols of Rome illustrated on those battle flags, when they were placed in the sacred precincts, the grounds that were considered sacred out, that extended out beyond the walls, that was the sign. It was a sign for the Christians to get out of Jerusalem. And when that took place, unexpectedly, for no known reason, the armies of Rome withdrew after they did that action. And in their withdrawal, of course, the Jews chased them, which was folly. But it provided opportunity for the Christians to get out of Jerusalem. And they did get out of Jerusalem. So the characteristics, prophetic characteristics of the abomination of desolation that were pointed to by Jesus, established in history and verified by Ellen White, is that the abomination of desolation is a sign for Christians to flee, and the sign consists of the mark of Rome's authority being placed in a place where it ought not be, okay? Or in the holy place. I'm not trying to deny the holy place, but I do want to have a little bit of expanded understanding. It's a sign to flee. So how can the pioneers justify saying that the abomination of desolation is the papacy? If you turn to Daniel 9, look at verse 26 of Daniel 9. Brothers and sisters, this is an important understanding, not necessarily with country living, but this is an important understanding about where we are today. Because in Isaiah chapter 29, we're told that at the end of the world, the leadership of God's people at the end of the world are going to be given a book that is sealed. And their response is going to be, they're going to be asked if they can read the book. And their response is, in Isaiah 29, I can't read the book, for it is sealed. Everyone familiar with that prophecy? Now, what book is sealed? The book of Daniel. All the prophets are speaking about the end of the world. In Isaiah 29, we better look there for those of some of your questioning looks. I won't take time there, but I do want to look at this and make a point. Isaiah 29 starts in verse 1. It says, woe to Ariel. Bible commentaries would tell you that that's another word for Jerusalem. Testimonies, volume 5. Sister White says Jerusalem at the end of the world is the Seventh-day Adventist Church. This is a prophecy about the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It's a prophecy about us. I'm not going to take time for the whole prophecy here, although it's worth considering. It's talking about the leadership of God's church. But look at verse 9. To stay yourself and wonder. It's talking about woe to Jerusalem in verse 1. This isn't a pretty picture of Adventism at the end of the world. This is a woe. And verse 9 says, stay yourself and wonder, cry ye out and cry. They are drunken, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Lord hath poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and he has closed your eyes. The prophets and your rulers, the seers, hath he covered. And the vision of all is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned. Now, you define what Isaiah means by one that is learned here. Generally, for me, that means in the culture of Adventism. That's those of the in Adventism that have spent some time in the educational institutions, in spiritual institutions, because this is a spiritual application of God's church. And it's delivered to one that is learning, saying, read this. A book that is sealed is delivered to one of the leaders of God's church at the end of the world that is of the educated group, saying, read this, I pray thee. And he says, I cannot read it, for it is sealed. Okay? But notice it doesn't stop there. It says, and the book is delivered to him that is not learned. That's me. I'm not learned. Saying, read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I'm not learned. I can't read it. It's sealed to me because I am not learned. Wherefore the Lord saith, forasmuch as this people draw near me with their mouth and with their lips, they do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by precept of men. Now, what I want you to see here is that there's two groups of people in Adventism that cannot understand the book that is sealed. The first is those in Adventism that are learned, whatever that means. You put your own category on that. But the other group that will not understand the book that is sealed are the people that believe that the understanding in the sealed book can only be brought forth by one that is learned. There's a group in Adventism, they're not going to study it for themselves, they're going to wait until someone stands in front of them and tells them, but they won't receive it unless he's learned. Okay, so there's two categories in Adventism. But why is it that they can't understand the book that is sealed? The book that is sealed, the book of Daniel. Let's look down here to verse 15. We'll start there. Verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. Woe unto them that seek too deep to hide their counsel from the Lord, and their works are in the dark. And they say, who seeth us, and who knoweth us not? Surely, notice this, surely your turning of things upside down shall be esteemed as potter clay. Brothers and sisters, the reason the people in Adventism cannot understand the book that is sealed is because they've turned something upside down. So when we're speaking about the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel, you'll always find that the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel is found in connection with the daily. And the pioneers believed the daily was paganism, a satanic power. But today, we teach that it's Christ's work in the heavenly sanctuary, a godly power. Brothers and sisters, it's been turned upside down. And when you take the daily and you say that it's Christ's work in the heavenly sanctuary, you destroy the understanding that the pioneers had that when it comes to Rome, in the book of Daniel, it's portrayed in two phases, pagan and papal Rome. And you destroy the ability to understand the message of Daniel for the end of the world. So, although we're dealing with the abomination of desolation here, let's be clear. This is very sacred ground. That's why Jesus said, whosoever readeth, let him understand. Because you do not find the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel where it is not in connection with the daily. And the daily has been turned upside down. When did the daily get turned upside down? In 1901. Who did it come from? By a man named Conradi, who is one of the most famous apostates in Adventist history. He's the man that's credited for virtually destroying any respect for the spirit of prophecy in Europe. And he reintroduced that old Protestant teaching in 1901. When's 1901? 1901 is the time period of the Alpha of Apostasy. And the Alpha of Apostasy, I know that many people have singular ideas about what the Alpha of Apostasy is, but the Alpha of Apostasy, in my understanding, comes with a multitude of alpha apostasies and a multitude of omega apostasies. There's an alpha apostasy in the health work and omega in the health work. There's an alpha apostasy in the gospel and omega in the gospel. But the alpha of prophetic apostasy was the daily, turning a satanic work into a godly work, turning it upside down to where you cannot read the book that is sealed. So what's the omega of prophetic apostasy? Well, brothers and sisters, the glorious land, in verse 41 of Daniel 11. Is it the United States, a satanic power, forcing the world to worship the beast? Or is it the Seventh-day Adventist Church, a godly power? Brothers and sisters, verse 41 of Daniel 11, it's his worth understanding correctly, because the argument in Adventism is it's either a godly power or a satanic power. I submit to you the type of the United States in Bible prophecy is paganism, pagan Rome, which the pioneers said was symbolized by the daily. So anyway, the big subjects here. Let's go back to the abomination of desolation. How is it? What are the characteristics the first time that the abomination is fulfilled in Bible prophecy? Rome's mark in a place where it should not be, and that mark is a sign for the Christians to flee. And I'm suggesting that the pioneers identified that the abomination of desolation was the papacy. And they do that from verse 26 and 27 of Daniel 9. It says, "And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince shall come, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with the flood. And unto the end of the war, desolations in the plural are determined." Now everyone, there's no argument at the first part of verse 26 that this is identifying that pagan Rome was going to come in and destroy Jerusalem and the sanctuary and put Christ upon the cross. But this verse says that the war continues on and desolations in the plural. The pioneers focus on this desolations in the plural, and they say this is identifying two desolating powers: the daily desolating power, paganism, and the abominable desolating power, the papacy. So they understood that this abomination of desolation that Jesus is speaking about is a term that is dealing with both these abominations of desolation and paganism and papalism, both. It in a general sense, but specifically when used in connection with one another, the daily is paganism, pagan Rome, abomination of desolation, papal Rome. So let's look at the characteristics one more time, only from the perspective that the abomination of desolation is the papacy. What happened when pagan Rome fulfilled the abomination of desolation? Well, came into Jerusalem, trampled down the city, came into the temple, and it was a sign for the Christians to flee, right? Very simplistic overview of the characteristics. Well, what is the classic characteristic of the papacy in the Bible? 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped. So he that as God setteth" where? In the temple of God. In a place where he ought not be, in a holy place, showing himself that he is God. So, yes, the papacy did come into the temple of God, but pagan Rome, when it fulfilled the abomination of desolation, it also trampled down Jerusalem. Revelation 11, verse 2. Revelation 11, verse 2 says, "But the court which is without the temple leave out, and measure it not. For it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. During the 1,206 years of papal rule, the holy city was trampled down. Now, I was asked to do a presentation on country living, and I agreed to it, and I forgot about it until today. So I didn't bring my notes on this presentation. I'm just going to have to tell you. I'm going to have to tell you, point you in the direction. Brothers and sisters, in Revelation, the church of Thyatira is the church of the papacy ruling the world. The church of Pergamos is the church during the time period of compromise. In Thessalonians, Pergamos is the time period of the falling away first. This time period of compromise coming into the Christian church is the time period that precedes the papacy being established on the throne of the earth. It's specifically identified in Bible prophecy. And if you go to Great Controversy, page 47, Sister White is clear that during this time period of Pergamos that was preceding and leading up to the time period of Thyatira, during this time period when the papacy was taking control of the Christian church, that the genuine Christians recognized that this was a time that they needed to separate from that apostate church, and they fled. Where did they flee to? They fled to the wilderness for 1260 years. That was the abomination of desolation. The sign to the Christians during the time period of Pergamos that was the sign for them to flee is when they seen Rome's authority in a place where it ought not be, in the Christian church, in the temple, telling itself that it was God, trampling down the holy city for 1260 years. That's the prophetic fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. The second time, those two testimonies, when put together, give us the characteristics of the third fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. And brothers and sisters, if you take the book Country Living and you look at the dates in the comments that are in the book Country Living, you will find that Sister White, prior to 1888, was talking about there would come a time when we need to get out of the cities. But prior to 1888, the time was still future. But after 1888, it was past tense. Look at the dates. And what happened in 1888? In 1888, the Blair Bill arrived in history. What's the Blair Bill? The Sunday law in the United States, brothers and sisters. Now, what did Rome do, pagan Rome? It came in and placed the mark of its authority in the sacred precincts, in a place where it ought not to be. And this was the sign for Christians to flee. In 1888, Rome's mark of authority came into a sacred place where it ought not to be, and this was the sign of Christians, according to Sister White, that we were to flee the cities, get out into the country in 1888. But when Sister White's dealing with pagan Rome in AD 70, she says pagan Rome mysteriously, unexpectedly withdrew its armies. Nobody knew why, but it did, giving time for Christians to leave. And in 1888, the Blair Bill did not pass. Why? Don't go into Advent history. Forget Advent history. Go into American history. Why did the Blair Bill, the Sunday law, not pass in
1888? Because many Protestant
churches came and lobbied against it. Yeah, maybe, but the primary reason is that there was one man that went into Congress and gave a presentation on why it was wrong, and he turned the tide, and his name was A.T. Jones. That's in American history, not just Advent history. And who was A.T. Jones? He was the messenger of the latter rain message. And brothers and sisters, it's at the Sunday law that the latter rain comes. So it's all right there. The potential was all right there. But what happened? Rome withdrew. Brothers and sisters, when Sister White says, and like I said, I don't have my notes here, the time is not far distant where we as the early Christians will be forced to flee the larger cities to the smaller cities in preparation to mountains. And she quotes Matthew 24:15, the abomination of desolation. She's saying that the Sunday law in the United States is the fulfillment, the third fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. And if you look at the first two times that they're fulfilled, the characteristics are is when you see the mark of Rome's authority. What's the mark of Rome's authority here at the end of the world? The Sunday enforcement. When you see that in a place where it ought not be, and at the end of the world, prophetically, where is the Sunday law not supposed to be at the end of the world? In the glorious land. In the Constitution of the United States. And brothers and sisters, the Constitution of the United States is a sacred document. It's a sacred document. That document is one of the documents. There's a few documents in history that God had his hand in preparing. Sister White says the United States was designed by God to be the great protector of religious liberty. And how did he do it? through the Constitution of the United States. And in the Constitution, he designed the separation of church and state, which is destroyed by Sunday enforcement. So when you see the mark of Rome's authority coming into the United States, you see the mark of Rome's authority where it ought not to be, and it is a prophetic sign to flee. And it came into history in 1888. Let me ask you a question. In Great Controversy, when she's talking about the first fulfillment of the abomination of desolation in the 80-70 time period, how many Christians died in the destruction of Jerusalem? They all got out. So, when Rome comes back, the Sunday law that's about to take place, how many Christians are going to be in the city? None. Brothers and sisters, our first test, although we haven't taken time to demonstrate to you, is the spirit of prophecy. 1 Corinthians 14:32 says the spirit of the prophets are subject unto the prophets. Sister White, don't speak against herself. She says, out of the cities, out of the cities, out of the cities. This is my message. That's her message. She would be speaking against herself if you didn't go back and look at the chronology of what she was saying, because there was a time period when she says she was speaking about getting out in the country was in the future, and then there the rest of them after 1888. It's past tense. But here at the end of the world, when we are seduced by the Laodicean condition, and we're seduced by the ease of living in the cities, and we're seduced by the culture of Adventism, we're not willing to look closely at those passages. Brothers and sisters, we were supposed to be out of the cities before our grandparents were born.
Brother, what did you say,
1 Corinthians 14:32 is what I said, but so let me make sure. Let me say one thing outside the scope of country living. These triple applications of prophecy, brothers and sisters, when you look at the different ones, they all give evidence that what we're suggesting about the last six verses of Daniel 11 is correct. And one of the arguments that takes place on those verses is who and what is the glorious land. And the word glorious in verse 41 of Daniel 11 means in sense of prominence. Some people say that this glorious land is the Seventh-day Adventist church, and I submit to you that, if you're going to be honest, the most prominent church in the world today is not the Seventh-day Adventist church. Okay? It just isn't. But the most prominent country in the world is the United States of America. Some people argue that this word glorious in the Bible has a connotation to sacredness in the gospel. And I say amen. Because there is a prophetic role for the United States. It was the great defender of religious liberty. It accomplished that goal through the Constitution. And the abomination of desolation, the triple application of prophecy, teaches that there is a time when Rome comes and places the mark of its authority in a sacred place, in a place where it ought not be. And this is an argument that the United States of America is the glorious land. There is a sense in prophecy where the United States has a sacred role to fulfill. Brothers and sisters, it's the focus of end-time Bible prophecy. If the United States was not the most prominent nation in the world today, just in the sense of nations, that would be one thing. But it is. But it's still secondary. Because the United States in Bible prophecy is the most prominent country in end-time Bible prophecy. You can't get away from that. This is where it all starts. This is the country that forces the whole world to bow to the papacy. It is glorious. In the sense of prominence is the definition. It is the glorious land. And there is a sense of its purpose, prophetically, that when Rome's mark is placed in that land, that's the fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. Brothers and sisters, get out of the city. Get out of the city. You know, if I would have had opportunity, in fact, when when Katrina was moving in, we were had a camp meeting with a Spanish camp meeting in Arkansas, Pastor Estrepo. And we were saying these very same things. But what I was going to say before I remembered that, if I'd had the opportunity before Katrina moved into New Orleans to go down and speak to Seventh-day Adventists in New Orleans, I would have told them the same thing. You need to get out of this city. And they would have got it. They would have understood it shortly thereafter. But, so, that's the end of that presentation.
Let's see. Okay. Here's the first two questions for you. Anybody in the audience have questions for him? I'll come pick them up. First one is, what is the definition of country and the definition of city? And then, do we need to be in the mountains?
How many of you know who Daniel Garcia is?
Yeah.
Daniel Garcia is working in
Portugal
now.
He was at Leah in Portugal.
He was at the camp meeting in Switzerland. And he spoke a few times. And he had a presentation on country living there. And he brought forward some quotes where my conviction, based on the quotes he shared, I wasn't so settled in this idea before, but my conviction is that the best place to be in the country is in the mountains. I mean, I don't think that what he was saying made that where that is the only place you can be. But ideally, if you're going to go in the country, there are positive benefits outlined in inspiration that the mountains are the best place in the country to be. But it isn't exclusive. The country can be in a place that isn't mountains. And depending on where you live, where I live, the people that live where I live, they say that the little hills around us are mountains. So that's relatives too. I grew up right here in California. I know what mountains are. I thought until we went to Switzerland and then we seen mountains. It's relative what a mountain is. The mountains in Arkansas are, are hills. So that for me, there was a brother here today that he was the first person baptized into the new Ridgecrest Church, which is now 25 years old. But when it was first built, he was baptized into that church, and my wife and I were the second and third people baptized. So I've known him since I first became a Seventh-day Adventist. And there was a time in his life after he went to PUC and graduated up there that he went into a self-supporting ministry in Arkansas for about 4 or 5 years. And we still kept in communication. And he used to tell me what Arkansas is like, about the chiggers and the ticks and the mosquitoes. And so when it came time for me to be looking for country property personally, there was two places I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be in Alaska because I was Arkansas. But I know, and my wife knows without a doubt that the Lord led us to Arkansas. He led us there. And brothers and sisters, I could pull up my pant legs right now and show you all the chigger and tick bites from Arkansas. It's real. There really is that many bugs there. And it's frustrating. I've walked by a row of broccoli one time and seen some bugs on them and came out the next day and they were a skeleton from the bugs eating them down in one day. There is some frustrations about Arkansas, but I know the Lord led us there. I know that's where we're supposed to be. And when it comes to being taken to the country, the first rule of thumb is to make sure that you go where the Lord takes you. If you're not convicted of that, it's going to be 100 times harder to deal with the polishing that takes place there. One of the purposes of country living is to finish the work of character development. And we're Laodiceans. There's a great deal of polishing the Lord intends to do with us. And that country living has a lot of ways that the Lord can buff this area or buff that area. So know that that's where you're supposed to be. Mountains are ideal. What city and country? I'm simplistic. I think you'll have to settle this in your own mind. But for me, I look back when Sister White was talking about getting out of the cities, and I look back to the population of what she was calling cities in those days and age, and I figure, well, what she was defining city life in, with those little towns back then, she was saying they were corrupt and they were cities, but they're what we would call little towns today. And I would say that the same size town today is much more corrupt than when she was alive, because even the little towns have the gangs and the TVs and the drugs and everything. So what's a city? What's a town? What's the country? I think we need to err on the extreme on that one. I like the town that we're living in. We're living in a little town. When we moved there, it had a gas station and a post office. And about 6 months ago, the gas station went out of business. It's 22 miles into the big city. And there's a smaller town maybe 12 miles away. Brothers and sisters, what we have to do in the country is accomplished through living in the country, and being in that country setting, allowing the work that takes place in that country setting to be the tool that the Lord uses to finish character development. And I understand the principle, but I can't really be pushing that too hard, because even though we're living in the country, I'm not home very often. I'm in a place like this. But we do live in the country, and I do believe the farther out, the better. But I also, when I consider country living, there's only a couple men. Is this appropriate? There's only a couple men, I'll say it anyway, that I have conviction that I know are pastors of the Lord. And there's one man that I consider a pastor, and he's... I've traveled all over South America with him. I have confidence in him as being a genuine pastor of the Lord, and he understands country living. And he has two ministries that he works with that his sons run, one in Colombia, one in Venezuela. And their rule of thumb is that you need to be far enough out in the country where you're in the country, living the country life. But you can't be so far out in the country that you can't reach the population, because during the little time of trouble, we still have to give the final warning message. And I know there are some in Adventism today that say if you can get 50 miles out on a dirt road into the woods, that's where you're supposed to be. And I'm here to tell you that in the little time of trouble, if you have to go 50 miles on a dirt road and then another 10 or 20 miles on a paved road, and you're having to do it on a bicycle because you can't buy gasoline to go out and give out tracts, it is a little bit more difficult. So I kind of tend to think that we do need to be close enough to a population center that we can still work during the little time of trouble, because we have a warning message to give during that time. So practicality, need to be far enough out where you can protect your children from the influences of the city, but close enough where you can realistically work during the time period when you can no longer buy or sell. Where you're walking to town, you're riding a horse to town, you're riding a bicycle to town. Right? And that's logic I have. Country, what is country or city?
Our next question here is, what about seniors going to the country? Many brethren are trying to discourage seniors from moving out in the country. And I've heard that only people with children, small children, need to move out to the country.
Now, Sister White speaks about banding together and moving out in the country. I don't think it's practical for, you know, elderly folks or single elderly ladies necessarily to move out in the country, but they need to get out in the country. And if they have a willingness, the Lord is going to open that door or lay them to rest. Let's be serious. We're at the end of the world. Let's be serious. If someone's faithful and they're honestly put everything on the altar of the Lord, and they're at such an age that in the Lord's wisdom, it's best for them to be laid to rest, they may be laid to rest, but their heart has to be in that direction. Now, if it's in that direction, I don't see why the Lord can't put them in connection with a younger group of people to do some of the things. When we moved out on our property, we knew it was of the Lord, and there was certain things that I was under conviction that I needed to get done. You know, what's the first thing you're supposed to develop on your property according to the Bible? The orchard. Before you build your house, you better plant your trees. And I wasn't being able to do things like that because I was traveling, and we were praying for help. And finally, my daughter and son-in-law decided on their own they wanted to move back there. And my son-in-law, I didn't know that well before that time. He's one of these jack-of-all-trades. I mean, he can do it all. And